Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCLFM, Clinton, New York. On the telephone with me, I have Dr. William Wise Weaver. Dr. Weaver, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Beautiful day.
It is.
After that terrible storm.
I am so intrigued by your book, Zauer's Herbal Cures. And could you tell us how you got interested in Zauer's and why you decided to translate this?
Well, I had known about the Zauer herbal for many, many years, and I had been dipping into it myself for information on herbs and particularly culinary material, because I'd been working on other books about the Pennsylvania Dutch culture. And it struck me that this book was so unique that it ought to be available in English. Bibliographies on early American medical works, and Zauer just wasn't there. So I thought, okay, we've got a huge hole in our knowledge of 18th century medicine, and I think it's about time that we plow into it. So I decided to translate this book, but that was an undertaking of like 2 or 3 years because it was a monstrous task.
Yes.
If you can imagine, I had to type the entire German into my computer so that I could then translate it, and my poor computer just nearly had a nervous breakdown. I had to turn off spell check altogether.
I bet. Wow. So what is your... I mean, are you familiar with the German language, or you had to hire someone to translate for you?
Oh, no. I did the translation myself.
Oh, incredible.
And what I realized is that he was using, Zauer was using a lot of very, very specific terminology for medical works and for herbal works. So I had to literally go to German medical treaties of the 18th century and figure out what some of these words meant, because the meanings have changed over the years, as you can well imagine. Of course, it's a bit like reading Culpeper's herbal in English. Culpeper is the 17th century English herbal, and he's speaking literally another language compared to what we use today. So it was very specialized, and I found myself flipping back and forth through 5 and 6 different books just to figure out what he was saying. And then on top of it, if I may add, Zauer himself inserted a lot of his own idiosyncrasies into the work. And, for example, when he got into discussion of sexual maladies and problems for women, he became suddenly very vague and used words that were kind of euphemistic in, because he was embarrassed to print things that were too blatant, you know, in his herbal. You have to remember that the herbal was unique because it was published in installment form in an almanac, so it didn't come out as a full-fledged book. Zauer himself was very much... but how should I say? He was very much an advocate for the poor. He was a Church of the Brethren, if you will, a Dunkard, somewhat like a Mennonite. So he was a pacifist. Mm. He had very definite ideas about why he was doing this, and so he was both an apothecary in Philadelphia, in what is now Philadelphia, Germantown, and a bookseller and a printer. So he said that he would make installments of this herbal in his almanacs every year, put another chunk in, and so almanacs being very cheap, that made them available to people out in the countryside where you had no doctors anyway.
Wow.
And at the end of about 10 years, you could collect all this material together, sew it up, and make a book out of it, and he would publish the index, and that's exactly what he did. So it's the first book printed in America in serial form as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, when you were talking about these subtle parts that you have to translate, I do remember reading in there when you had mentioned something about bit of sarcasm that was being used when he was referring to white pearls, which was some kind of a reference to sugar for
oh, yes.
The rich.
Yes, he he lived in Germantown, which was is now a section of Philadelphia. It used to be an independent township in Philadelphia County. Long story, but Germantown in the 18th century was up on a hill. So the wealthy Philadelphians, the merchants, had their summer houses there, and there are still a great many big mansions in that part of the city. And they would go up there for the summer to cool off. Well, evidently, some of these wealthy ladies came into his shop to buy things, and he didn't like them. And they must have exchanged words. He didn't like vain. Vain people. And you can imagine these 18th century ladies with their powdered wigs might have been quite a bit overbearing. So this comes out in the book because they seem to like, they seem to have gone after a lot of the sweets that he had. He had medicines, you know, embedded in sugar, and they would buy these and eat them like candy. And he didn't think that was very, very proper. And he makes that quite clear in the herbal.
Yes. I noticed that there's a lot of, peculiar things in the herbal that I don't see in other herbals. I'm interested in herbal medicine, and one particular reference is he talks about making a vessel out of ash wood to drink out of, and that this is going to have a beneficial effect on the spleen.
Yes, that's quite interesting. I don't think many people realize that the ash tree really had a lot of, well, presumed medical benefits. Not only the wood, but the flowers and the seed pods and on and on and on. Even the mushrooms that grow off the bark, that kind of thing. You know, it's very funny because I have seen these mugs, wooden mugs, in antique shops, and I never made the connection that they might be made of ash wood and that they had some kind of a medical purpose. But evidently, the idea was that if you a beverage of some kind in this wooden vessel, the oils in the wood would you know, migrate into the drink, and then this would help you.
Mm-hmm.
Totally new to me, but there it is.
Well, that's another fascinating thing is that many herbal books neglect trees as medicines, and there's quite a few references to different types of trees in here.
Absolutely true about that. Many herbal, many botanical herbals just deal with the small plants, the annuals and the perennials in the garden. And trees were very important. Well, think of the sassafras as a Native American plant that was used quite extensively. The roots, the berries, the leaves, the young leaves. This is an important area of botanical medicine that we often ignore. I absolutely agree with you.
Another part that gets me is that the book has so many references to things that I would normally think of as food, not as medicine, such as apples, and I believe that there was beets in here and turnips and parsnips.
Yes. Well, I think you have to realize that Sauer's medical concepts, his whole worldview, was very much 17th century, so he was a bit old-fashioned even in the 18th century. In one respect, he still hadn't divided food as pleasure away from the idea of food as medicine. So in his worldview, diet and cures are all part of the wholeness, if you will, and so everything you eat is also important because this is part of preventing illness, if you will. And if you've got it, then there are certain foods you can eat, in boiled or mashed or whatever, that can help cure or ameliorate certain conditions that you've developed. It was the French, you know, who took the idea of food as pleasure and separated it away from medicine and created it as this gourmandizing thing that you just, that you enjoy. But like a glass of wine, getting drunk and all that, and having fun. So it that starts in the 18th century. And now, of course, we know if we eat too much food like that, we get into trouble anyway, and we're sort of back to the idea of homeopathic medicine and food as prevention. And now people are afraid of food, even, and we have bulimia and all these problems that have developed. Sour was still part of that old idea that food and medicine are not separate. Mm. That's where that comes from.
You know, in the herbal, I've never seen this described anywhere else. Under apples, it says, apples are commonly divided into six categories, namely watery, dry, acidulous, sweet, wine-flavored, and spicy.
Yes.
Have you seen that anywhere else?
Those concepts were in Zwinger, a Swiss botanical herbal that Sauer dipped into Zwinger's herbal for a lot of his medical information. And that idea about apples was in circulation, at least among medical physicians in the 17th century, and I think even a little bit before that. It makes sense if you understand where they're coming from, and if you know anything about heirloom apples, you can immediately think of apples that fit all those different categories: Esopus Spitzenberg, Benoni, Arkansas Black. I've got these old trees in my own garden collection, and also those categories relate to apples in their various stages of storage. So you can take a Golden Delicious, for example, and when it's off the tree, it can be very crisp and watery, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But when it's in storage, after a while, it can get what my grandmother used to call punky, dry and grainy and almost like cottony. And those are the textures that Sauer is referring to, because in his mind, eating apples at these different stages had different effects on the body. And if the apple's beginning to ferment, if you will, in storage, this is going to affect your digestive system. So there's something that's going on here that we've overlooked. And I noticed years ago, I had an old cousin, Mary Larkin Thomas, Quaker lady, Orthodox Quaker, strict, homeopathic, her practitioner. Her grandmother was an herb granny. Her mother was an herb granny. This woman never took medicine. And so when she was finally forced to go into a home for care later in her life, when the doctors gave her aspirin, it acted like penicillin on her body because she had never been exposed to it. And so what we're seeing here with these apples and all of these subtleties is we're dealing with people who have never been drugged up on modern medicine.
Mm.
And so their bodies are reacting in very subtle ways to these small nuances that are coming to them from natural medicines. Am I making myself clear?
Yes. Wow, that's quite amazing.
Yeah. And Cousin Mary sort of rang the bells in my head. I said, okay, some of these herbal remedies are not going to work on people today who've just, their bodies are full of antibiotics and all of that kind of thing because their whole immune system is messed up. But if you start from scratch and you've got this clean system, some of these herbs are really going to work the way they're promised to in the old herbal. So this is one of the problems we face today. It's not just a matter of using the herbs. It's like what are we taking into our bodies from the environment, and you know, bear aspen, whatever. It makes a difference.
Now, does Sauer predate the industry of the Shakers selling medicines and seeds?
Yes, Sauer does. Sauer died in 1784, so that puts him a little bit in the pre-Shaker period. I think the Shakers broke away from the Quakers, in the early 1800s, and then I think by the 1820s they get into their herbs and medicines. So they're a good generation later.
Another thing,
but they were very important, of course.
another thing I'd like to mention here is that as we're going through the book, it's an A to Z of these different herbs. You go through one at a time and go into depth on each one, and you give Zauer's the translation of what Zauer had said. But before that, in italics, you have a great backstory for each one that you've put together.
Well, I thought it was important that I do that because, first of all, I rearranged the herbal, as you can well imagine. It's alphabetically according to the English name for the herbs, so it's not in the same order that it would be if it were in German. Well, I thought, if you just throw this out, people might not get a handle on some of these remedies, so it would be better if I can give it some context and mention what's going on at the same period in colonial Pennsylvania, for example, and among the Pennsylvania Dutch community. And so those headnotes are really meant to help the reader better understand that particular entry and also the herb involved. I had a terrible time identifying some of the plants, and I was only wrong on one of them, and it was called long pointed dock, and I wasn't sure what that was, and I finally I sort of left it up in the air in the translation, but I was going through an old Greek medical work from ancient times, and there it was, and the Greek word made it very clear to me that it was patient dock that they were talking about. So sort of subsequent to publishing the book, I found out what that herb was. But there are so many entries where Zauer uses a vernacular name, and by vernacular I mean a common name. Mm-hmm. And if you go into German, you'll find out that common name could have been used in Bavaria for one herb or in North Germany for another. And that becomes, which one is he talking about? And so I had to do an awful lot of back reading just to figure out some of the terminologies. I would say probably the nomenclature could be updated a bit, but this is another issue that you run into with herbs. It's that if you get into the Latin nomenclature, you realize that there's a culture war going on out there, because the Germans will call a plant by one name, the English will use another, and the U.S. another, China another altogether. So a lot of this these plant names really aren't settled yet. I've often thought to myself, wouldn't it be better if they were just neutral and we gave them an ISBN number or something? Each herb has its number instead of a name that is culturally specific. And because when you get into go to a conference where you've got botanists together, maybe you've been there, there's the hair splitters and then there are the lumpers together mm-hmm. types, and there are all these battles over what to call a plant, and I'm thinking, let's get over that. Let's get down to the business of using them.
Yes. So speaking of using them, how many of the recipes or remedies in here have you personally tried?
I've probably tried about half of them, because I have a very large herb collection, and I have many of these same plants in my garden. Some of them I'm using in ways that Zauer would not have recognized, but I've tried them, and it's very interesting to see how they work. Some are very subtle and slow. Others, like peppermint, you get an immediate effect from that. If you've got an upset tummy or something, it really does settle the waters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I've tried all of them, because this was a massive work, and some of the plants aren't that easily accessible to me. So it would be nice over the years to sort of work one's way through this herbal and see what goes. I use chamomile, for example, in composting. So this is a totally different issue, but it's taking herbal medicine and applying it, in a sense, some of the same theories to your garden methodology. So there you go.
Another, while we're on that topic, the only thing that I've tried out of here is a candied burdock root, and it came out very well, and people tended to like it.
Oh, very good. Yeah, using the, you see, because there was an issue of preservation in those days, they had no freezing, so freshness was an issue, and the only real way to preserve your medicines was to dry them, and drying isn't always the best thing for some herbs, because drying them out destroys their properties. So the other way was to embed them in sugar, and this more or less held them in limbo so that you could use them off-season, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I've done candied elecampane. I've candied a number of things. Rose petals. I think he has a recipe for that, making rose petal jam, sort of thing.
Have you done calamus?
Yes, indeed. I have done that, too. I don't like the taste. I don't know. It's just me.
Uh-huh.
But you have to realize, I don't think people understand that, for example, the rose, the damask rose, is very, very alkaline. And that alkaline characteristic was very important in medicine, because you can actually use it on bee stings. Bee stings are acid, okay?
Mm.
So you take an alkaline material to counteract poison. So it works very well sometimes for little bug bites and things of that sort. And I can see why this was useful and why it was an important thing to have around the house.
Another one that struck me is I've never seen chocolate listed before, and the what it says about it was that it's an expectorant, and I've experienced that from eating chocolate, but I never really thought about it in those terms.
That's a very interesting comment. I personally don't like chocolate, so I don't I don't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even enjoy it. So when I read about this being an expectorant, I thought, yeah, exactly. I know where that's coming from, because it to me it's like chocolate is like lard and instant coffee. That's the mental image I have when I bite into a piece of chocolate.
Uh-huh.
But if you take a very a piece of really strong chocolate, I suppose it would work that way. I have chocolate beans. Now I like those to nibble on. It's interesting how that would happen. I suppose you'd really have to have a lot of it to make it really bitter enough to make your stomach react. But
I go for the darkest of the chocolates.
Yeah, well, the darkest probably would be that. Another thing, though, you're talking here about something that was very expensive in the 18th century, and so you have to ask the question, well, first of all, who can afford this?
Mm-hmm. Another thing, there's so many parts of this book that really strike me, and one is that we have a farm and we grow parsnips, and we have a CSA, and we grow parsnips, and we also grow lovage, and I always felt that there was some kind of affinity to them, and I'm always wanting to put them together, and then I read in here that I think it was under the parsnips that it was often combined with lovage.
Yeah, well, you know, they're both members of the same. They're umbellifera. You know, they're cousins, botanically speaking. And of course, you could add to that parsley and Hamburg parsley, carrots, white carrots. All right, you've got all sorts of affinities there, and it's not surprising that they would be combined. However, the parsnip leaf is not that good for you. It's got little hairs on it that are going to that actually will irritate the skin. Did you know this?
No, I didn't.
Oh, there are people who react to parsnip leaves as though they've been exposed to poison ivy. And actually, it's even worse than that, because the scars look like burns from a fire. I was doing workshops in my garden, and a woman came, and she was attending it, and she actually showed us her wounds, because her parsnips had bolted. In other words, they had run to flower, and so she was pulling them up to throw them away and taking armloads of these to the compost bin, of course, exposing lots of her body to the leaves. She was really suffering from that. So you've got to watch parsnips. I think it's, I'm trying to think of what the chemical is, but it's not very nice.
I hadn't heard that it was, that there were hairs on it before, and I guess I hadn't paid close enough attention to notice the hairs.
Well, they're there. It's the same material, I think, as on stinging nettle, but a little bit more potent. It's to the point that I wouldn't recommend anyone making tea from parsnips leaves. Okay,
right.
This might not work. This might be terrible. The parsnip root, fine. Do with it what you want. But you'll notice in stores that parsnips are never sold with their leaves on the way carrots are.
Ah.
And that's one of the reasons, because in handling them, people can have a reaction. So I guess the point of this conversation at the moment is that there are herbs out there that are pretty potent. And, if you're homeopathic, then, of course, there are no toxins. It's all a matter of dosage. But that parsnip, the greens, are definitely something that would have been used in small quantities. Now, the seeds of the parsnip plant are entirely different, and they can be used very much like the seeds of lovage. In fact, I think people use them in distilling. And the green seeds are okay on the parsnip plant. They don't have those hairs on them. So it's not just this blanket taboo. It's the different parts of the plant at different stages. You have to know your plants in order to know what part of them is useful and when. I guess that's the lesson here.
Yes, like the burdock seeds have those fine hairs that are like fiberglass.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Same with the parsnip.
Okay, that's terrible.
Well, the burdock plant, you know, these plants developed these protections because they were good to eat. And they're full of nutrients, so nature gave them protection.
Another question I have for you is, I believe that Zauer mentions using different types of metals, some things that we would consider now to be poisonous.
Oh, yeah.
Could you talk a little about that?
Well, I haven't tinkered with that part of the herbal. I overlooked... Well, there was a whole branch of herbal medicine that inherited ideas from alchemy, medieval alchemy. And so metals had certain curative properties, gold, silver, you name it. And they were actually using mercury, of all things. And to me, these were medicines of desperation, because there are plenty of other ways to find cures. But I think this goes back to the idea that humans have always been looking for that silver bullet to get that cure into the body as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And these metals are part of that. But look, we could jump back and go, as I mentioned in my introduction, there were a lot of things that even Sauer gave up, like mummy dust and the jawbones of certain fish, things that for some reason in the Middle Ages that these were thought to really be fabulous cures, and that was really just a lot of hocus pocus. It was a lot in the mind, but this mummy dust thing was quite important, because there was an international trade in mummy dust, and this is one reason why people in the Middle Ages were going into tombs and raiding them. They were after the mummies, not the artifacts.
Wow.
And also, there's something in Sauer that maybe we haven't mentioned, and that's the because we talked about food, this idea of boiling food for long periods of time had to do with the idea that people emptied their chamber pots in their kitchen gardens, all right? So there was a fear of worms, intestinal worms.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an underlying medical concept in Sauer's book, because there's a lot of fear of worms going on here, even though it may not be said explicitly. But it has to do with this fact that they were putting their night soil, as they called it, in the gardens, and they were afraid of getting worms because they thought in this period that worms were carriers of black plague. They didn't understand where that came from, and so there's just a whole lot of material in the book about worms and vermifuges. That's the word for it, and it has to go. It goes back to this this idea that worms were carriers of the plague, and they didn't want to spread the plague. So people cooked their food to death, really, because they were trying to kill worms in the food. And that's something I ran into in the culinary part of this, and it took me a while to figure out where it was coming from and what was this fear. But now we've got other fears. We don't worry about worms in the food as much as we worry about other stuff. But anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up because there's a lot in this herbal on instructing you on how to cook things on plate stoves and how to keep things warm. Putting a box of sand on your old stove and then setting a jar in it with water in it, for example, and then herbs, and then it infuses in this warm sand, and this is how you make health drinks and what have you.
Great idea.
I'm sorry. I'm getting you off track, but I just wanted to mention that because it's something that's in here, and there's a reason for it.
My favorite insights come from things that are off the track. So please
okay.
do. I'd just like to mention to listeners, it's 9:30, we're halfway through the hour. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to reach us here in the station, the phone number is 859-4200. That's 859-4200. There's an exciting entry here about elecampane, and you mention in here, in your preface to the translation, about the type of water that's used. Pare and cut the roots into thin slices. Let these stand overnight in conduit water. And then you explain to us what conduit water is, which I just found that interesting. It's brought into a city via wooden pipes, usually elmwood, and it could be obtained at public fountains, and the intention of the recipe was to ensure that water was pure and clean and not taken from an open spring or river. In short, it meant water certifiable drinking quality.
Yes. You see, that was one of those issues that I had to nail down by going into other period sources. I used Voigt's Schatzkammer, which is a German encyclopedia of medical terminologies and definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And thank heavens, Voigt was himself very learned, so he would explain things in Latin, which was a great help to me because I can read Latin, whereas Sauer didn't explain things,
uh-huh.
and Voigt could be very, very specific, and he would even, sexual remedies, he could be quite explicit because he was writing in Latin, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I got the picture that way, and you have to realize when people are in Europe, their source of water was very important, and well water was extremely valued because of its purity. We don't think of this anymore because we're drinking spigot water. Well, people drink bottled water for the same reason we do here in Philadelphia. The spigot water is a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But the purity of the water was very, very, very important in the effectiveness of many of these old remedies, again, because people's bodies responded in very subtle ways to these environmental things that we've sort of lost because we're so hyped up on chemicals and we're breathing air that's absolutely a disaster. Anyway, on and on we could go.
Right.
But that's a very interesting point about elecampane. I love that herb, by the way. It's beautiful yellow flowers and big leaves. It makes a nice ornamental, if nothing else. And may I add, Sauer's Herbal is out of print, and we're trying to get the reversion of rights on it so we can get this republished.
Oh, that'd be
and
wonderful.
Back in, Yes, back in circulation, because it's hard to get. You can find it on the internet, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I certainly would recommend it to anyone interested in herbs or history. Also in the Ella campaign, it says that it possesses numerous balsamic components, and I see that word a lot in old herbals, and I'm wondering if you could tell me what that means.
Balsamic, you know, we have this word very common in supermarkets, balsamic vinegar. Balsamic meant that it had curative properties, that it was healing. Balsam, you know, there's what do you call it? Lemon balm. All right.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that cures and soothes.
Hmm. And then it goes on to say about it that from which it draws its capacity to open, dissolve, and so I'm noticing in this book that he continues to talk a lot about opening blockages, dissolving obstructions, and that seems to be a big theme, is that the body has many things that are gumming it up and blocking it and obstructing the flow of things.
Yeah, well, it goes back to this whole thing of Sauer's medicine is basically geared towards the blood, the circulation of blood in the body.
Hmm.
And therefore, a lot of his remedies concentrate on the organs of the body that regulate your circulation, liver, kidneys. I mean, the kidneys are, you're cleaning the blood, all right? It's all part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees blockages in the liver, for example, or even in the digestive tract, which are messing up the whole circulation of the blood. And in order to be a healthy, balanced human, you've got to have good circulation. So it all goes back to this idea of keeping the plumbing clean so that it can work well.
Mm-hmm. Also then in Valerian, he says, Valerian possesses the virtues of warming, drying, and dissolving sick humors trapped in small glands.
Yeah. That has to do with the idea that thick humors are, well, you know, you've got this lots of phlegm in your throat because you've got a chest cold. That's a thick humor, okay?
Mm.
And the idea of drying, you see, would be to make this phlegm shrink and go away. And so that's what he's talking about. It makes sense if you realize where they're coming from with this type of cure, and warming and drying is what you would need because thick humors are cold and wet. So you're going back to this humoral system of medicine where you're using opposites to help cure one another.
And did that humoral process or strategy come out of England?
No, it comes out of ancient Greece.
Okay.
All right, but it's similar in some ways to the Ayurvedic medicines in India. So this is a whole system of medicine that evolved through observation, trial and error. They didn't know the chemistry that we know today, but they observed, and they could see what happened when they combined certain herbs with certain maladies, and then they got certain results. And over time, they were able to refine this system and to make it work as well as they could. So that's where that comes from. It's Greek. You can go back into the old Greek texts from ancient times, and you'll find these same ideas.
Now, I may be completely off on this, but I was wondering if when we're talking about dissolving certain things, if there are certain solvents that are in the plants that actually do dissolve.
That might be true. I'll tell you, there's another thing that came to my mind while I was doing this book, and that we have a lot of these old herbal remedies out there, like this dissolving characteristic. We haven't really sat down and figured out why they worked for most of these. We know some of them. I think we've studied mint a lot because mints and chewing gum and the big companies, the big pharmaceutical companies have analyzed what's going on there. But a lot of these other minor herbs are the ones that we haven't thought much about. Nobody's really done any work on this, so we don't know in modern terms why they work.
Mm.
What was the thing that caused it to happen? There was something there. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the herbal, and they'd noticed that there was something about that plant that made that reaction happen. Yeah.
What does the term glutenate refer to? I'm looking at cinquefoil, and it says cinquefoil and its root have the capacity to dry, to glutenate, to withstand acidulous corruptions, nullify bitter poisons, and cleanse and heal.
Glutenate, well, it means that it's... glutenate is... I know what he means. Let's see here. Let's try to put this in simple words. It means that it's as opposed to dissolving, it's making something stick together.
Mm, okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
I can't think of a clearer way to put it, but I do know what you mean.
It's like making blood coagulate or
okay.
Making cheese curdle. That's what that word means. It's as opposed to making, let's say, breaking down phlegm mm-hmm. with something warm and dry. It's doing the opposite.
I see. And
it's something you would want to have if you're trying to stop blood from flowing from a wound or something of this type.
All right? I see.
Mm-hmm.
I find cinquefoil to be a particularly alluring plant, just in its the way it presents itself.
It's pretty, and it has a beautiful name, doesn't it?
Yes. And then this was one of the most interesting entries in here about for consumption. Take freshly pressed juice of cinquefoil, strain honey from the comb, and fresh may butter, all of equal weight. Cook until it thickens into an electuary, then store in a glazed plain redware pot.
Mm-hmm.
And people are using this for tuberculosis, is that right? Consumptive?
Yeah, yes, that's right. And then that important thing is using the may butter because it's the freshest butter from grass that had. We're talking now about grass-fed cattle, not corn-fed.
Right.
And they've got a lot of beta carotene in their grass and a lot of other things that are coming in. So that there's probably a positive medical. Medical property, even in the butter itself. But
mm-hmm.
this is quite important to make an electuary. Electuaries were sticky, moist preserves, if you will, that basically had some kind of medical property. The Pennsylvania Dutch call apple butter lotvedic, and that word comes from electuary. It's just a peasant term for electuarium. The Latin word, and it's because the apples cooked down until it's a paste, and that's essentially what your electuaries were. It was a paste, and you could eat them with a spoon. And this one from the this particular herb is also concentrated. So technically, theoretically, you're getting. More of the components of the herb in that electuary than you would be if you were just using it green in tea or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that fascinates me is to think about putting these herbs into fat, like you have here with the butter, because as people can see with marijuana, that there's certain chemicals within the plant that fat can draw out. So to think of that and relate it to other medicinal plants is another interesting crossover.
Yes, this is true, and it's very funny that you bring this up because I'm interviewing lots of Pennsylvania Dutch folks all over the state, and I was interviewing a woman up in the Mahantongo Valley, that's in central Pennsylvania, and her mother was well known locally for her cures, and I was interviewing this daughter, who is now like 97, about food. But this cure discussion came up, and this whole issue of fats, that's where I'm coming from here.
Mm.
Her mother rendered snakes for snake fat. She used duck fat and also goose fat in much the same way that this butter is being used in this remedy that we just talked about, that it became a matrix, if you will, for preserving certain things and then used on the skin or on wounds or what have you. I was most amazed about the snake fat, putting this dead snake in her oven and then rendering the fat out of it to use for medicine. But this was an eye remedy. You put it around your eyes to get rid of the bags and the darkness.
And so was it just the rendered snake fat, or was there
There were other things in it, but she was but specifically for this eye remedy, I remember it had to be snake fat for one reason or another. I probably have this on the tape somewhere, but this was just like totally out of the blue, and I thought, wow, this goes back to sour, and they're using butter, and this makes sense. It's part of a folk medicine.
Wow, so she was really using snake oil.
Yes. Yeah, I guess you would say so.
So, also in cinquefoil, then it says store in a glazed or plain redware pot. So, redware would just be an unglazed pot?
The redware is earthenware, all right?
Okay.
It's porous, and it would be unglazed. I think it's better for some of these medicines that they don't go into glazed redware, because redware almost universally was glazed with lead glazes, and they knew this in the old days. And it would react with anything acidic, which produces lead salts. All right, you can actually see this if it happens. It's white, and that's deadly poison. So, glass or stoneware, your stoneware crock. You know, the gray ones that are really hard, they're fired at very high temperature, and they're dense, they're not as porous. That kind of storage utensil was very important for some of these remedies, particularly if they were on the acidic side.
And then do you know if you're using something that's the redware, is that hard to clean out because it doesn't have the glaze on it?
Yeah. Redware is porous, so it's going to absorb whatever's in it. And in the old days, when the Pennsylvania Dutch cooks in the country were cooking in these old earthenware pots, they had a set for meat, they had a set for fish, they had a set for whatever, because the pots would take on flavors, and you can't get that out. So you just have these different sets that you use for whatever it is you're cooking, and then you have a special set that you use if you're making herbal remedies, because you don't want to pollute your medicines with something that's coming out of food. Am I making myself clear there?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Another part of the book that really fascinates me is all these different waters that he's talking about, and there's an explanation in the Lily of the Valley entry about making these distilled waters.
Yeah. Well, the idea of the water was again, you don't have Lily of the Valley all year around, so you're going to take traits of the Lily of the Valley and transfer them to these little waters that you then can use over the winter. And he uses waters a lot, and he mixes them. This is something quite interesting. And Lily of the Valley is technically poisonous. I can recall in recent times a wedding cookbook that was totally recalled by the publisher because the cover was a wedding cake decorated with real Lily of the Valley flowers, and they didn't want to kill anyone. What is it you want to know about this?
Well, I'm interested in learning how to do the waters, and I was wondering if you would recommend a certain type of hardware for doing this distillation.
Well, yeah, I think the best thing would be a glass alembic. Do you know what I mean by that? It's
yes.
The little distilling. For the people listening, it's bulbous on the bottom and it comes up to a point, sort of, and bends over. And so when you're boiling material inside, it evaporates, and then the this is how you get your waters and oils. It evaporates and then drips into something that's cool. I would go with the glass because that's the cleanest. If you use metal, sometimes there are copper alembics, but I wouldn't go that route. I would use glass, and you can get these, by the way, from various suppliers.
And
in fact, I think there are people who are making reproductions of 18th century alembics and distilling materials. They don't have to be very large. I don't think they would hold more than a pint at most, because you're not doing a lot at once. At least when you're doing these waters, it's something very, very, very small scale. And also another, he makes waters out of petals of different flowers, and that's very delicate work. This distilling thing was often done by women. It was something that that I think Sauer's wife was involved in a lot of these. Processing a lot of these remedies, but he never mentions her. I think she was the candy lady, to be honest with you, because she was well known for her sweets, and she probably knew all about making things with sugar. So, yeah.
Have you given any experiment to the waters in the book?
I haven't done the waters, honestly. I even have an old alembic, and I even had a little stove to go under it, the little thing on 3 feet. Where you put charcoal inside, and I haven't done this. No, to be honest with you, I'm in new territory. I have a large kitchen garden. It's almost in half an acre to maintain. So
wow,
that's
quite large.
Up a lot of my time.
I'm also interested in some more obscure entries here, like chimney soot.
Oh yes, that was used in remedies and. I'm not sure, other than it's carbon, what it was supposed to be doing. But there's a whole section in there on using soot, and I even have a picture in the book of a soot scraper, because it wasn't soot from just any part of the chimney. It had to come from the place where the stove feeds its smoke back into the chimney, and that was supposed to be the purest soot, if soot can be pure.
Right. Also, I see cobwebs were an entry here.
Cobwebs make sense. They're used to put over wounds, and they act like a bandage. It's kind of gauze. It's a very delicate form of gauze. Think about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And some cobwebs are pretty strong. And you have to realize he compiled this herbal for people who live out in the country, for the poor farmers who don't have any doctors. They can't just go down the street in, like, the city of Philadelphia in the 18th century, had lots of doctors, but out in the country, no way. So he's giving you ideas on how to make do with what you've got at hand.
Right. That does seem to be very much a theme in his work.
That's one of the basic themes for this book, yep.
Also, there was a couple entries in here for using earthworms.
Lots of earthworms, yes. I'm not quite sure, except that they're pretty rich in protein. Birds love them.
Yeah.
What this earthworm is meant to do, to be honest with you.
I think that there are references to using earthworms in Chinese medicine, so maybe we would learn something there.
We might learn something. This is one of those parallel pieces of research that probably I should do, but it's there.
Uh-huh.
So, and open to experimentation. Worms are not difficult to find.
the sap of birch. Anything that you'd like to mention special about that? We are coming close to the season for
tapping
trees.
Yeah, well, the birch tree. Yeah, I'll tell you, the birch tree itself is almost an apothecary shop waiting to happen, because the leaves, the catkins, the bark, the sap, all of these parts of the tree, even the root, were used. Birch beer, okay. I also know that the black birch in particular was very popular as a folk remedy plant in Pennsylvania. The little stems have a kind of wintergreen taste, all right? And so you can make a tea, like wintergreen tea, for winter coughs with it. Also, stakes of birch wood, let's say green, young growth off the tree with the bark on it, they were put into sauerkraut to keep it from going off.
Oh, so really?
Yes, and I have that fact in my next book that's just coming out in April, in the sauerkraut recipe. So they were using, there were a lot of strong chemical components in that tree that were being used in a variety of ways. There's something antimicrobial about birch trees, and I think we need to know more about this, because even in Europe, birch beer, birch wine, birch sap was being used in the Middle Ages in remedies.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very fascinating. And something I love about the book is these little facts that are noted that aren't necessarily having to do with medicinal herbs or the healing plants, but just side notes, like under the butterbur, it talks about how it used to be used for wrapping butter when it was sent to market, the leaves.
Oh, yes, that's true. A lot of these plants had practical uses. Well, it's a good insulator, for one thing, kept the butter from getting warm and soft. There's probably something antimicrobial in that leaf as well. Because I know my grandmother's mother, when she sent butter to market, she wrapped them in the leaves of rhubarb. And, of course, the rhubarb is toxic, so it keeps things off the butter.
Oh, wow.
There's a reason behind this. Sometimes we have to dig to find out what that reason is. But people were very smart, and they figured these things out years ago.
And it's exciting to think of an alternative, like using these leaves, because they're biodegradable, and the alternative, well, I mean, you could use wax paper, but if you're using plastic, it has a lot of toxic phthalates in it that people are just starting to understand the toxicity associated with it.
Exactly. And so that's, I think we need to go back to more of these green wrappers, if you will.
Yes, I agree.
Because you can compost them then.
Yes.
And put them back in the soil. I don't consider anything waste if I can put it in my compost bins, because it's food. It's just going to be reprocessed.
Agreed. Would you like to tell people where they can learn more about your work and any websites, or would you like to list some of the books that you've authored before we go?
Well, Heirloom Vegetable Gardening is one of my big books. It's available online from Mother Earth News on CD. That's all about heirloom gardens. Sour is out of print, unfortunately, so you have to get that off the internet. I'm setting up a center for regional food studies at my, and you can read about that at williamwoysweaver.com. Once the center is up and running this year, I will separate out williamwoysweaver.com from that, and at my website there'll be a lot of material on my books. So I would say I'm in a holding pattern at the moment.
Okay.
But my next book is called As American as Shoe Fly Pie, The Food Lore and Fake Lore of Pennsylvania Dutch Cuisine, and that's coming out April 5th, University of Pennsylvania Press. Lots of recipes.
Wonderful. Dr. Weaver, I'd love to have you on again and talk about a different topic.
I'd love to talk with you.
Okay, thank you so much.
It's been fun. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Same here. Bye.
Mm-hmm.